Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are and why we are here and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in a series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Greetings, Earth Explorers. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. Welcome. 2 days ago on the Sun, a magnetic filament snapped. The resulting explosion hurled a CME, which is a coronal mass ejection, into space and sent beautiful waves of energy surging through the Sun's atmosphere. This CME might strike a glancing blow to Earth's magnetic field today, sparking a mild geomagnetic storm, so northern sky watchers should be alert for auroras tonight. However, the CME was not squarely aimed at Earth, so it may never arrive. There are no sunspots, and the solar wind is very low at around 320 kilometers per second. We here at X Squared Radio want you, the listener, to do three things for us. We have committed to bringing you all of our content for free. You can listen for free to the live broadcast, the archives, and even the podcasted archives. All we ask is that you do the following. When you get ready to buy inkjet cartridges, historical replicas, or other neat stuff for your space, please shop the affiliates at X Squared Radio. The prices are amazingly low, and in most cases you get free shipping. Sign up for our newsletter, and third, send us the call letters of your local AM radio station. If you'll do those things, we'll make sure our sponsors and affiliates pay to bring you this program at their expense. Next week, we have on our program John Lash. We'll talk about his new book, Not in His Image, and the real details behind the 2012 End Times predictions, and the secrets of the Dendra Zodiac. John is a very articulate speaker and writer. You don't want to miss that program. Well, Earth Explorers, I know you've been patient. Millions of you have been waiting for news about the new movie, One Anunnaki, by Jaguar Films. John Gress, the writer and director of the movie, has taken great care to get the details right. He started filming at age 4, making his own special effects directly on the film. He also wrote, performed, and produced his own music. Now the president and founder of Florida Effects, he has taken on the challenge of bringing the most incredible story of human development in history to life in what promises to be one of the best independent films ever made. Hopefully, the first movie of the trilogy will debut during the Sundance Film Festival in October. Well, tonight, in a world-exclusive and premiere interview, John Gress has agreed to appear on X Squared Radio and share with you the splendor of his new film. Please welcome with me John Gress. How are you this evening?
Good. How are you, Brooks? Good evening.
I'm doing excellent. We are so pleased to have you here on the program. We have read about the Anunnaki in the Bible. We have been privileged to have the Zacharias Sitchin books and have him share his excellent research with us. We learned about the arrival of the ancient Anunnaki on Earth, but the details of what happened and what they left for their descendants is a mystery still.
That's correct.
One thing is for sure, we want to know more, and that's why you're here tonight.
Okay.
But first, could you tell us how you became fascinated with the subject of the Anunnaki?
Sure. Brooks, like many people, at a pretty young age, I happened across some information on, and I don't remember exactly which book it was, but there was a book about alien life planting, seeding the planet of Earth at some point. And actually, the whole gist of the idea of the movie came about during a discussion with a friend of mine who was a very ultra-conservative religious kind of a guy, but he was very open to discussing the creation stories and the differences between fundamental religious beliefs and sort of the more esoteric creation stories that may seem to conflict diametrically with the creation stories in the Bible. And as we got into the discussion further and farther, he started pointing out examples from the Bible. And as we sort of together explored what they meant, he pointed out Genesis, story of creation. And when we started looking through the wording, there seemed to be these, as a lot of your listeners I'm probably are pretty familiar with, these big contradictions, these big open spots in the wording that left us with not answers but bigger questions.
Mm-hmm.
One of the initial things that stood out to me right away, and at first I thought my eyes were deceiving myself, and I thought maybe I had a misprinted Bible we were looking at, was the first words when it actually speaks in the Bible about God creating man. And as most of us think we're familiar with, when we're used to hearing it in church or temple or whatever the religious preference is, we have it ingrained in our head that the wording says something to the effect of, and God created man in his image. And this is really the key sentence that got me started on this whole thing, was when I looked at the wording, lo and behold, it actually said, let us create man in our image. That started the questions going, and my first question was, maybe I had a misprinted Bible. So I went and I got the King James Version, and then I got a Hebrew Bible, and then I had, and I started pulling every Bible I could find, and again, lo and behold, that is what it said. It was in the plural. So as I started embarking on researching possibilities for this discussion, and the idea started trickling into my head of perhaps doing a production about this or a screenplay, I started doing interviews with religious people, with priests, with rabbis, just getting input. What are your views on this? What does this mean to you? And unfortunately, the responses I got back were very disconcerting. They all seemed to have an answer for them, but the answers were very vague, and the answers were not very satisfying, which left me with more questions. And then in the end, the end reaction was the same. They both ended the conversation with me completely. The conversation just came to a complete halt, and nobody wanted to discuss it anymore.
Yeah, I always like the answer, well, that's a mystery, my son. We're not meant to understand that.
Exactly. So what happened was, as I started researching, and again, I became familiar and doing my own research with many of the Sumerian, from the original Sumerian stories, I became very hungry for information, and I read Sitchin's work, and I read Kramer's work, and I read anything I could find. I was digging up anything I could find. I went and visited the University of Chicago's Mesopotamian and Oriental Institute, and I got whatever books, whatever researchers had from there, and only to find that the information, number one, on the topic as a whole was very limited. It's very hard. You really have to dig hard to find accurate information from the actual archaeologists who did the digs in those periods of time, because obviously they were, I guess, cut off at some point in history, and we were basically restricted to access to this information. But the more I dug and the more I find the original Sumerian stories, the first answer sort of popped out to me, and that was in the Zeusudra epic. And in the Zeusudra epic, one of the other, besides the original creation, in Genesis, where God creates man, the Noah's Ark epic is probably the second most popular and controversial epic of the creation stories.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Noah's Ark epic, the one thing that I believe in your book said the same thing, which was, it just seems unconscionable to get two of every animal into a boat. I think it was in your book. It had mentioned something about needing a boat the size of the state of California.
Yeah,
it just
that's exactly
didn't seem
right.
It didn't seem to make sense. And I had also read another author who had done very extensive research in the actual area where the flood was supposed to have taken place, and his data showed that once all of this water came on the earth, if in fact it was as the biblical version says, where would all that water go? It would be impossible for that amount of water to leave the earth in that period of time. It would have to go somewhere. So those two questions sort of got me off and started. And when I read the original version, the Sumerian version of the Zeusudra epic, which was one of the early predecessors for the Noah's Ark epic, one of the answers sort of shot in my face and came to light and hit me. And the wording, and I think I've only seen it in the Zeusudra version of the epic, the Atrahasis and earlier or later versions don't have the wording this way. But in the Zeusudra epic, it doesn't say take two of every animal. The Zeusudra epic specifically says take the seed of every animal. And I thought that was a very interesting twist on the story. Because that would seem like a much more viable way of saving the contents of a planet.
Sounds like a lot more science was involved in the second version.
I'm sorry?
Sounds like more science was involved in the second version, like maybe we're going to freeze dry the seed of all these animals and then take them with us, and that would take up substantially less space.
Absolutely, The thing that's so shocking about that is that the Zeusudra epic precedes the biblical story by some 3,000 to 4,000 years. That's an enormous amount of time
that
to have such a scientific explanation.
Well, that sounds like all of that really aroused your faculties. So how did you come up with the idea for the film?
Okay, well, once we got into it farther and farther, and as my curiosity grew, I started researching more topics other than just creation. We started looking into revelations, and we started looking into different facets of the biblical account. And one thing I want to sort of point out right off the bat, a lot of people are very sensationalist in their take on the whole alien seeding humanity topic. I never took the sensationalist counterpoint off the bat. My object wasn't to be sensationalist and to just cause a fight and to cause an argument. I think there are enough people out there doing that, and I think that a lot of them spend so much time trying to be sensationalist that they overlook the scientific evidence and the facts, and they're just trying to spark reaction. My view was not to prove or disprove anything. It was to just explore the subject and see where it took me. And fascinatingly enough, where it led me to was not a disproof of evolution, not a disproof of the biblical version. It actually led me to, similar to where your book and your findings have led you to, which is a proving of both, where they both literally prove each other and coincide with each other. So my idea for the movie came when I started, actually it started on the Revelations end of it, and I was very fascinated with some of the Revelation stories. And some of the Revelation stories, if you read them from the frame of mind, and what I did when I did a lot of these was I said, I put myself in a room and closed the door and lowered the lights and said, this is written some 2,000 years ago, give or take. If you were a person back then who'd never seen an airplane, who'd never seen a movie of a missile coming out of, you know, a Poseidon coming out of a submarine, if you'd never seen any of that, but you had the knowledge of what we have today, what would these things represent? Some of the things that they talk about are pretty frightening. When you read Revelations based on your knowledge of today, but as if you were speaking from a time 2,000 years ago with no knowledge of these things. And
you know, that doesn't sound so fantastic. I have tried myself to learn several languages, and one of the languages that I've become fairly good at is German. And one of the things that I've noticed with German is very little of it is anglicized. They have these large compound words from fairly primitive roots that describe fairly complex things.
Right.
For instance, we use the word entrepreneur, which is adapted from French, which, you know, means somebody who goes out on their own, who goes their own way, who has their own ideas. But in German, it's Unternehmensleidenschaft. You see, all these compound words are put together, but when you read, say, the works of Ezekiel,
mm-hmm.
and you see his description of these war machines that he was shown of the latter day, he used his current language. And when that was translated into English, you get these, you know, really weird scorpion things that
right.
lightning bolts and roar like a lion.
Exactly. And some of the things are so much simpler than it sort of starts bothering me the more I've delved into this over the past 20 some odd years, the more annoying it gets to me when people start coming up with these giant complex explanations and derivations of things that are, and I'll give you a great example. In the Moses story of Moses leading the people out of Egypt, they followed a column of smoke or a column of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. And that's an interesting visual, if you will. I live in Florida, and from where I live in Fort Lauderdale, you can, on clear days when they launch the space shuttle from Cape Canaveral, you can actually see it lifting off from here. And interestingly enough, the space shuttle forms a pillar of fire at night and a pillar of smoke during the day.
Wow.
So the visuals start almost explaining themselves. So anyway, back to the original question, what got me interested, as I said, you know what, The Bible, as pretty much everyone knows, is probably the greatest selling story book of all time. If the Bible is based on stories that actually preceded it by 2,000 to 5,000 years, that would sort of seem to make those stories at least a pretty good seller, if not one of the interesting stories.
Cecil B. DeMille did pretty well with it.
Yes, he did, and a wonderful movie that probably was a big inspiration. I had always seemed to like those kind of giant, epic-sized movies when I was a kid.
You know, I went to an art gallery, and I saw the original Cecil B. DeMille paintings that he had done, which were sort of the, I guess you would call them gels today.
Right.
The inspiration for shooting the movie, the staging of the movie. And the detail, and these paintings are huge. They're like 96 inches wide and 10 feet high. Just
right.
Tremendous amounts of detail. And I can see where he got his inspiration.
Absolutely. And you know, the interesting thing about today is we're in a very unique time in the history of filmmaking and special effects and visual storytelling as a whole, in that it's getting closer and closer to present pretty much anything that you can imagine, you can pretty much bring it to life at this point.
Yeah, exactly right, especially with a great company like Jaguar Films and Florida Effects behind you. I know you've got a great track record in the film industry already.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When we first decided to do this, this has been sort of a pet project that I've been researching and writing, and it was very quickly upon starting the project that I realized that it was way too big to do in one movie. There was just no physical way of doing it. In addition, we're not a Hollywood company; we're an independent company, so we don't have the budget to do a Cecil B. DeMille Ten Commandments. Although that is really what's required of the Anunnaki story and the Sumerian story of creation. So that's sort of where we came about with the idea of breaking it into three movies, making the first one a modern one. The other thing is that there's so much resistance in the population to anything that challenges current ideals, anything that challenges, people are so reactionary to the people who are sparking the reactions and the way that they presented it as so sensationalist. I sort of felt that, you know what, maybe the best way to approach this is to take a gentle approach, introduce people to the idea, let them see what this story is about and how amazingly interesting and fascinating it is, introduce them to the characters of the story and gently bring them in by way of a science fiction, and let them see, when they walk out of the movie, they're going to say, hey, that was a pretty great movie, hopefully, and when they... 2 weeks later, when they're talking to their friends, someone's going to talk about the Anunnaki in a conversation, and they're going to say, oh, I know about that. And somehow, by osmosis, they're going to pick up the basis for the whole story of the Sumerian version of creation by way of this movie. Hopefully, that will spark an interest enough to them to be let down their resistance just a little bit and open up to the idea of, hey, I'm not attacking your beliefs. This is just the version of the story that the biblical version that you're grown so comfortable with is based on. And I think that scientifically that's kind of a no-brainer that it's been, you know, I don't know how much resistance there will be. I know there's always going to be, the minute you say what you're saying is different from popular belief, you're going to be attacked.
Well, you know, as popular as the Bible is, and we don't want to take anything away from that.
Right.
The notion that we are not alone in the universe has never been more popular than it is right now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I know you've done many years of research on this subject, so
yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the Anunnaki. I mean, these beings are not simply a tribe mentioned in the Bible or by ancient Sumerians, right? These are actual off-worlders.
Correct.
And I know the name... Anunnaki can mean, well, it can mean many different things. Based on Hebrew interpretations, it's rich with meaning. I mean, An is short for Anachnu, which means we, and An also means heaven, and
Correct.
Naki means clean. So The name can mean we are clean, and heaven is clean, clean as in pure, and ki means earth. So we are here on earth, or heaven is on earth.
You know, correct.
Anu is here on earth, and the we is also meant as a collective oneness. So, you know, we've got a lot of hidden meaning in the word Anunnaki, but, you know, what did you find as you researched the actual reality of the Anunnaki?
Well, I'll tell you, it's very interesting. As much as you would think there would be conflict between people who are religious fundamentalists and people who believe in something other than religious fundamentalism, I found, and I what I did was, and this is kind of an interesting story unto itself, I opened up a news group on the internet a number of years ago before I got into, I had written the first story and I was working on the second one and integrating them. And and that's a whole other story into itself because I originally wrote it all as one giant story. But I opened this group up basically to because there was so little information, I figured maybe one of the best ways to get the information on the Anunnaki and other views that aren't documented is by hearing stories from the way it was passed down from the Sumerians to the Bible, which was word of mouth, family members, people passing down stories over time. So I opened up this news group basically to get input. If you know things about the Anunnaki, if you've heard things, if there's things that you're aware of, let us know. Let's discuss it. Let's open a safe forum for discussion. And the interesting thing I found was that there was more dissension between the Anunnaki believers as to who the Anunnaki were and are than the people who don't believe in it at all. I mean, I don't think I could get a big consensus of there's a big section of believers who are very big Sitchin fans, and those people sort of are a little more cohesive in their beliefs. But in general, we've heard, I can't even tell you the number of completely opposed viewpoints as to who they were. They were the original angels. They were the original devils. They were the original vampires. They were everything from Satan to God, and,
yeah,
and that pretty much covers the spectrum, I think.
Wow.
So in my research, I sort of came to the point where rather than doing what I had been criticizing other people of doing, which is reading into things too much, I decided to take a tact where I'm going to try to present the stories as they were presented to the best that we know that they were presented without putting my own spin on it. And as I got further and farther in, the question that kept popping up was, well, is this pro-Bible or pro-creation or vice versa? And what I came about with was a very interesting tact, sort of just by way that the whole project was going, and that was, I said, it's pro-both and con-both. It actually both proves creation and the Bible, and it also disproves both. So you're all right, and you're all wrong.
Well, you know, truth is truth.
Exactly.
And one of the things that, if we're going to agree that the Anunnaki existed, and they're mentioned in enough ancient texts that we can just say they existed, if we're going to take the record at its face value that they did exist and they did interact with people on the earth.
Right.
One of the first questions I think people want to know is, when did they arrive on Earth?
Mm-hmm.
So does your movie address that?
Actually, this movie, we brush over it lightly in this movie. The second movie, and let me give you sort of the layout of the way the movies were laid out. Because the first and most sparking interest in the whole project came about by way of Genesis and by way of the Noah's Ark epic, we sort of focus this movie, which is the first movie, and I hate to be cliche, but it sort of just worked out that way, where the first movie is actually the second in the trilogy. And that was really more for practical reasons than anything else. It budgetarily, you got to remember, for a small independent movie, most large Hollywood productions doing a special effects movie of this sort have hundreds of artists working for years together. They hire every every special effects house in town to take a piece of it and break up the job so that it becomes manageable. We have a small core group of very talented artists working their tails off. So it became important for us, number one, we knew the scope and size that we were trying to project, and we said, well, we have to at least make it workable. So we took it as a modern-day epic rather than trying to do the giant period piece first.
Well, we're used to these mega flicks starting in the middle of their epic story and working backwards and forwards at the same time. So we're getting used to that.
And you know, I should point this out, too. It was very important to me that this not be two things. Number one, it was important for me for the trilogy not to be three of the same movie, only we're fighting different people.
Mm-hmm.
That's always kind of annoyed me. You know, this movie we're fighting these people, and then the next movie we're fighting these people. I wanted them to be three independent movies that are completely different and stand on their own, which they are. The second thing that I wanted to be sure of was that this didn't become a flashbang visual effects fiasco. It was important for me that this wasn't just about as many special effects as you can get on the screen, but that the movie stand up on the basis of its dramatic action first and foremost, even if it had no special effects. So that was sort of critical importance to me, and I think in the first movie that we did a good job of blending both the dramatic action of a modern-day science fiction along with some eye-popping special effects that are going to make people say, wow, you know, that's pretty interesting.
So you're going to develop the character of the Anunnaki or the Anunnaki in your films, right?
Yes, and actually what we do is, in this first movie, which is, again, the second in the trilogy, we introduce them, and basically the gist of it, without giving away too much of the movie, is the ancient Sumerian stories, and as you said, there is tons of documentation to show that at least the ancient people had a very working knowledge. If these people were not real, they had a great working knowledge of them if they weren't real.
Yeah.
So there's a huge amount of documentation about the Anunnaki up until the flood story, and then maybe shortly after, there's some biblical tales, as the Bible shows, up through the New Testament, and then it sort of dovetails off, and then you don't hear about them anymore.
I found that, too. You find them before the flood in Genesis, and then you find them specifically mentioned after the flood, like in Numbers chapter 33, and even in the early New Testament, they do talk about tribes of that name.
Right, and what's interesting too is that the ancient Sumerian stories do make reference to they have different names that they called it, but they do make reference to earlier pre-times that were beyond the average scope of what most people know about the Anunnaki being here. There are mentions and kings lists and things going back what would be unconscionable amount of time for us. Some references go back hundreds of thousands of years that they arrived. You know, in many of the different researchers' work, they show that they come back periodically, that every so many thousands of years there were big jumps in technology. So there were some theories that they may go and come and go and come. But the bottom line is that we haven't heard anything from them in a couple of thousand years, most likely.
Mm-hmm.
However, there was a few things that caught my attention, a few stories, and some of the stories said that during one of the points in time after the flood, the gods apparently were aging more here than they did on their home planet. The Anunnaki were aging here more than they were there, and the concern came up that they might not be able to go back if they were here for any length of time.
I see.
And that gave me an interesting idea. And you know what, before I continue on that vein,
Doctor,
I point out that...
Hang on, do we have a call on the
line?
Yes,
do you want us to put through calls and beep you now or wait?
I tell you what, let's go through the first hour, and we won't take any calls, but the second and third hours we'll take phone calls.
You got it, I will tell them all to wait.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Great.
One of the things that I wanted to point out, too, was I took great care in not only stating the stories the way that I saw them and not by my interpretation or not anyone else's interpretation of them. I try to state exactly what the stories were without rewording to whatever level I could avoid doing that. But more importantly, I tried not in any instance to infer that we know everything about the situation. But we know everything about this information. We have to accept that there's a huge amount of information about the whole subject that we just don't know. That's a big blank space for the moment. So rather than trying to fill in those gaps, I chose to leave them as gaps and present it as information that we just don't know right now, so we're not going to speculate on.
Oh, good. So you don't solve everything in the movie, so people will be leaving going, wow, I need to find those answers.
Exactly.
You never know where they're going to come from.
But to give you an idea of the care we took, and I know that anybody who's seen our website has commented on the spaceships that we designed. The interesting thing is we didn't design those.
Yeah, exactly.
Those were designed some 6,000 years ago.
Yeah, that's a very good replica. We have several ancient drawings in our first volume and in our second volume. And when I saw your flying wing in your little trailer on your website, I said, "Oh my gosh, they replicated it exactly."
Well, what we did was we said to ourselves and when we sat down with our 3D designers and when we all sat down together, we said, "Look, we're not creating something new. What we want to do is we're taking the assumption that these drawings and carvings that you see were not things that people imagined. They were just simply trying to jot down what they saw flying overhead."
Yeah.
So we had to actually try to go back and reverse engineer the drawings to a working vehicle. And there was actually a very interesting thing that popped up as one of the first things. And again, this whole journey has gotten more and more interesting as we went along. When you take the picture of the wing disc, and we said, well, you know what, those wings are great, but according to a lot of the ancient stories, these things just sort of shot up into the sky, and that would sort of preclude them from doing that. But you know what, it's interesting how the wings, when we reverse engineered them, could be made to fold in.
Oh.
And when the wings fold in, similar to, you know, the newer stealth fighters and the F-16s have wings that actually come in and out to help them for higher speeds or better maneuverability, they extend. We said, what if these things could retract, because they did have feathers and they sort of have that telescoping look. We tried it, and interestingly enough, it worked. And again, we're not saying we know how they were built, but it's just interesting to note that as we reverse engineered these from the drawings, it was feasible to make the wings retract, and what you're left with, surprisingly enough, is what very classically looks like a UFO.
Yeah, a disc.
It's a disc that looks surprisingly like the stereotypical UFO.
Now, these winged craft, the ones that have the extensible wings, they're probably the working craft for, you know, down low to the surface or working in an atmosphere.
Correct.
My personal feeling is there weren't fleets of these that traveled across space for 10,000 light years to get here. There was some giant ship that sort of carried everything because they did a lot of work here, and they came here for specific reasons. And,
right.
And maybe that we can discuss a little bit about that. But where do you think they came from?
Well, you know, the writings that I have referenced all seem to point to, and again, I have two sort of methods. My first method is to research whatever I can find, and then my second method is to sort of put the sonar out and see what comes back to me by way of our news group and people who've heard stories and read stories. And I mean, I have to tell you, you know, once you delve into this topic, and I've always tried to keep it to a very scientifically oriented train of thought, you go way off the deep end as far as the outer limits of people into paranormal as well, and some of the reactions you get back are, you could call them disconcerting, you know, but I always try to keep an open mind, even with some of the most paranoid out there sounding people who have interesting spins, it's interesting to find that sometimes there's a strange thread of truth that seems to be in this wild, crazy, outlandish person that you would think would be locked up. In the story, though, you know, you go, you know what, this whole story sounds very ridiculous, but this one little piece of the story, that actually could make sense. And I'll give you an example of that. I hope I'm not diverting too much from the topic. There came up a large discussion about 2 years ago on our news group of a grand deception. A grand deception by the original people the original aliens who came here to create us and who they were. And the topic came up that there was actually more aliens than just one group. That one group came in and were the ones who created us, and another group sort of kicked them out, took over, and then demonized the original ones. Now, this sounds like the story is getting even crazier. However, when you compare apples and apples and you look at our world history, if you were to tell me that we have a country who a leader comes in and erases history and says that the previous leader was a demon, didn't exist, you would say that's nuts, that's crazy, you can't do that. There's people who will know. However, as you and I both know, people coming in and trying to rewrite history has been a reality on this planet more than just a handful of times.
Oh yes, been recorded many times.
Many times over in the communist countries, a dictator coming in and trying to rewrite history in the Egyptian times, each new pharaoh coming in and trying to rewrite history was a common practice.
Sure,
so the thought of, well, you know, and now we have this other factor where maybe the Anunnaki who came in aren't really the Anunnaki who the stories are talking about. Now you have to take into the equation, are the stories you're reading fabrication to cover up another story? And obviously you can only go down that trail so long, but it's just an interesting thing to keep, sort of a thing to keep in the back of your head with a grain of salt as you're going along.
So, getting back to the original question about where they came from, we're not talking about distant galaxies or alternate universes, but you know, are we talking about a planet in our own solar system?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question and an interesting topic. There's many views of this. One view, the common and the followers of Zechariah Sitchin would say that they came from the planet Nibiru, that's another planet within our solar system. It's just so far out there that we don't see it. Sitchin's been amazingly accurate at many of his interpretations of the writings. And we now know that in the outer Cooper's Belt, there's more than a lot of extra planets floating around there or large objects that they considered Pluto a planet, but there's objects out there larger than Pluto. So could that be a possibility with a planet that enters and leaves the solar system in a retrograde orbit as he speculates?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. We actually even have one, and this is actually another neat little side note. I hope I don't disconcert you by interjecting these, but there are interesting things along the way. We have one of the members of our news group who has done his own research, a lot of scientific people in our news group, and he's projected what the actual path is for this planet. By the way, and again, I'm not a physicist, I don't have some of those faculties, but he seems to be very confident, and he's even run it by some NASA astronomers who say, yeah, you know what? By the way that this would affect other planets and other bodies, this orbit could be a feasible thing. And so it's interesting to see that some people feel that it's a planet in our solar system that we just don't see for a couple thousand years, which would sort of preclude us from seeing it. Or then there's other people who believe that it's from a planet in another galaxy, in another solar system, coming from the Pleiades, coming from Orion. We've had so many diverting factors, and again, we get back to the point of we're humans. Our lifespan's in the realm of 120 years at best. There are going to be things due to our life limitations that we are never going to understand about the universe just because our descendants may, but right now we won't because we just don't have the longevity to find out. Even if the planet that's in our solar system, even if Nibiru is a planet in our solar system, by the time it gets back around to us, we may, you know, our great-great-grandchildren may still not even be around to see it.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I think to me, by way of the story itself, to speculate that they came from another planet is enough for us. And what's interesting, though, is in the early versions of the stories, they do make some descriptions of Nibiru. So I think it's pretty safe to say that even though we may not know exactly where Nibiru is, that we know some things about it, and those are the things that we're going to present.
So you're going to show the arrival of the Anunnaki to Earth.
Well, that will be in the second movie.
Okay.
In the second movie, and again, let me get back to sort of explaining the layout of how we did this.
Yeah,
the first
sure.
movie, which is the second in the trilogy, will be a modern-day science fiction, but will basically address the Anunnaki's presence here on Earth from the Flood up until today. The second movie is the Sissel B. DeMille Ten Commandments pre-Anunnaki history up until the Flood, and then the third movie is a futuristic movie based on the end of this movie, very far into the future.
Well, I guess it's no wonder that the ancient civilizations thought they were gods. I mean, do you think they know what was here? Do you think the Anunnaki knew what was here? Or do you think they were just explorers just like us and just happened upon this little blue ball in space?
Well, there's some clues that lead me to believe that they did know we were here, that the planet was here, and that pre-human hominids were here. Those clues are basically the ancient creation stories in the Ziusudra epic, and as you so artfully point out in your book, all the different creation epics that there are in all the different civilizations around the world through time. And some of those are the fact that the original creation of the Earth seems to have included an interloper of sorts from outside the planet that had some sort of interaction with our planet, leading to our planet being partially destroyed before, you know, we existed, and then the creation of some other, you know, the asteroid belt, perhaps the moon, and a number of other celestial indicators, let's say.
I do believe
that the initial writings do point to the fact that they had some working knowledge of that there was a historical tie between the two.
Right. So they came here with purpose and with a specific design.
Right. And again, there's a lot of different dissenting views about what they came here for, why they came here. You know, there's some classic views that they came here to do mining, and there's some views that they came here to get as a way station. And I don't know if I would agree with all of those, but what I do agree with is that I would say that they did know about that this planet was here, and they did know that fundamentally it had some sort of connection to theirs. Now, interestingly, if the two planets had some sort of prehistoric collision of sorts, or one of their satellites had a prehistoric collision, could lend itself right there to the fact that our planets were seeded similarly with similar plant life, similar DNA for, you know, prehistoric life forms. So that's an interesting topic right there to sort of dive into, is that if there was some sort of, you know, pre-evolutionary collision between these bodies, it would lead to the fact that we have similar ties, we have similar DNA, we have similar, at least the original core DNA that developed over time.
Well, it appears that when they got here, or at least sometime after they got here, they decided that either their workforce was not large enough or they had some other need. But there's evidence, at least in our genetic makeup, human genetic makeup specifically, that somebody has been playing with recombinant DNA experiments.
Right. And that's basically the start of the sticking point between the fundamental religion sect and the people who are into creation and the people who are into far out kind of alien concepts.
But it really shoots a lot of holes in the evolutionists because, you know, we know, at least from a molecular biological point of view, that DNA can't do by itself in nature
right.
what has been done to our DNA. And we also know that in evolutionary forces, there must be some survivability advantage to the mutation. You don't just mutate a being weaker because the weak don't survive in the population. So when you look at modern humans...
And let me interject right there because you're making a fantastic point. Not only does weaker not follow along with the evolutionary thing, but the length of time it takes to actually create a genetic mutation that's a certain severity doesn't happen in 1,000 years.
No. No, it doesn't. It needs to happen over millions of years.
Exactly.
And there needs to be an environment that allows that organism to survive and procreate.
Right.
And if you look at humans, you know, we ovulate different than any other being on the face of the earth. Our skin is weak, our bones are weak, our eyesight is weak, our hearing is deplorable for survival as an animal on this planet. We just could not have evolved here.
Exactly. And it's very interesting to note when you're exploring this topic how we suddenly evolved or suddenly changed from a primitive type being on the planet to a much more sophisticated, much more intelligent creature in a very surprising period of time. And when you say it shoots a lot of holes in the evolutionary theory, what's interesting is, and again, the way that I approached this whole thing was by not saying I'm going to shoot a hole in this or shoot a hole in that. I took it as, let's just see what this... Here's this piece of the puzzle, I'm just going to put it down here, and here's this piece of the puzzle, I'm going to put it down. Here's the evolutionary piece, and here's the creational piece. And they all fit together. And there wasn't, none of them really needed to be shot down because they all sort of fit neatly together as you know, people who look at the globe, the map of the globe, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see that, hey, this piece used to go here.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of good evidence. Actually, we have a guest coming on in a couple of weeks that's going to talk about that, and he does an excellent job at that kind of research. But let me talk about one of the pieces that one of our listeners brought up.
Okay.
He says the ability to telepathically communicate does answer some of the questions people ask, like, is Star Wars accurate in that all beings in the universe understand English even if they speak Wookiee? So do the Anunnaki come here able to communicate with the humans that are already here, or did they bring humans with them?
That's an interesting angle. First, touching on the telepathic mode of that, I think there is something to be said for the working knowledge of science that we have on the human brain and knowing how much of it we actually utilize and... knowing the unknown things that have taken place over the past few hundred years that have been documented in the realm of some sort of, let's call it, some sort of extrasensory thing going on that we have. In our movie, we do address that to an extent. We try not to overdo it because, again, it's a big question mark and a big unknown, and our object is not to create a new history. We're trying to sort of stay on the sideline and show what's known about it. But we do feel from some of the early Sumerian writings that they did believe in some sort of divination ability, some sort of ability that some of them had to have some sort of extrasensory type of ability. We don't know how much or how far we do. We made it a small part because we didn't want to it to become a witchcraft kind of thing.
Yeah, but I'm glad you're addressing that, because that's a pretty important point for people that are familiar with this genre of history, I'll call it, because there obviously is some feeling that people have, and they communicate it to me all the time in emails. They feel like something is about to happen, or they have a thought or a dream or some kind of image that pops into their head that they've never seen before.
Well, here's an interesting, and again, on my exploration in my own life, I sort of, to address that in two different ways. The first way is, let me put it this way, I was doing an exploration, and I was very interested I've always been interested in new mediums of visual communication. And as a kid, I got very interested in holography. And I went to an independent holographic researcher who happened to be a very quirky kind of guy, kind of an introverted hermit of a guy, but he was an amazing genius in creating custom holograms. And I sat with him. I came in, and he sat with me one day, and he said, "You want to see how to do this?" And I said, "Sure." So he showed me. And the first thing he did was brought me into this big room, and in the middle of the room there was a giant granite slab that was probably 3 to 4 feet thick, resting on giant truck tires. And he said, "Well, the first thing you have to know about creating holograms is that it's created with an interference pattern from lasers."
Mm.
And he showed me what that was, and then he said, "Now here's the second thing you have to know. Everything in this world affects you. If
can we develop this in our next hour, because
sure, absolutely,
coming up on our first break, and we want to let you know that there are 3 hours to this program. So if your station isn't carrying all 3 hours, let them know we're still here, and we'll be back right after these messages." Foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. You own an inkjet printer, right? I used to purchase my replacement inkjet cartridges at a national superstore that will remain unnamed. A few months ago, I replaced the color and black cartridges, and the cost was nearly $80. Well, no more. Now, I purchase all my inkjet cartridge and copier supplies from 123 Inkjet. Now, I pay less than $15 per cartridge, and I got free shipping. Plus, every time I buy, I have a chance at winning a brand new printer. How cool is that? All you have to do is click on the 123 Inkjet banner at X Squared Radio, and you get exactly the same savings. Excellent printer supplies at super savings. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. You know we have revealed to you the ancient prediction that natural disasters are going to increase in power and frequency in these times. We might not always have the National Weather Service or the Emergency Broadcasting Service. So you might want to get your hands on some of the best weather reporting instruments around. Visit Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio and pick up something that might be useful. They also have the neatest gifts for your favorite people who like things for the outdoors or for their meditation garden. Check out Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio. One of the things we have learned here at X Squared Radio from our emails is that many listeners to this program are educators. Well, we have recently added a great affiliate for you. The Academic Superstore is the place where you can buy software, neat tools and gadgets, and even supplies such as calculators and iPod peripherals at huge discounts. The best things for the classroom and for the students are just a tax-free click away. All you have to do is click the Academic Superstore sign at X Squared Radio and start saving. You probably know Kevin Smith as one of the premier talk radio hosts in the world today. Well, now there is a new reason to know the name. His new book, Gods in the Garden. It's a shining light of truth in print that takes us back to the origins of mankind. Don't be afraid to find out who you really are and where you came from. The answer will open the windows of knowledge for you, so you can see everything for yourself. Visit his website at kevinsmithshow.com or purchase it at the online store at X Squared Radio today. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Our guest tonight is John Greff. He is the writer and director of the new movie that's going to debut this fall called One Anunnaki. Those of you in the least familiar with the story, at least to go and tell your friends that they're about to be able to go to a theater and see the story instead of having to read 12 books, plus our books. You don't want to forget our books. And we were, in our last hour, getting ready to discuss his introduction into holographic photography. So you can continue.
Hi, Brooks. When I met with this gentleman, for those of you who are just tuning in, as a kid, I happened upon the subject of holography. And on my introduction, I met a very bright, quirky kind of a guy who took me aside and showed me the ropes on how it worked. And when we walked into his studio, the first thing that I noticed was this giant 3-foot to 4-foot-thick slab of granite that sat on these giant truck tires. And he showed me how the lasers worked interference patterns to create the holography. But then the thing that struck me the most strange, and as a kid I was a little frightened by him, to be honest with you, because what he said to me was, he said, everything on the outside, everything in this world affects everything else in this world. And if you don't believe that, and he proceeded to pull out a whole bunch of destroyed holograms that were, you're used to seeing good holograms that look great when you look at them. And these were all destroyed holograms that looked awful. And he said, see this one? This was a truck driving by. And what he meant by that was that as the truck drove by, the vibrations from the truck, which, and again, the street was, you know, a good 100 yards away, but the vibrations traveled through the building, through the concrete, through the insulation he had on this granite, through the granite, and somehow made its way to the photographic plate and disrupted it. He said this one was a car crash that happened about 2 miles away. This one was a thunderstorm and the thunder that hit 5 miles away.
Wow.
And I was a little spooked by the guy because he was a little creepy, but he the point he made is he looked me in the eye and he said, you do believe in telepathy, don't you? And I said, I don't know. And he said, well, he said, let's put it this way. If a car crash happens 5 blocks away and the vibrations of that car crash hit you and can destroy your hologram here, who's to say that a plane crash 100 miles away, the vibrations of that can't be felt by someone on the other side of the planet, and someone attuned to that type of stress might not understand or know how to interpret that kind of vibration.
So there
is something to be said for the whole idea of ESP, of telepathy, even if it's not in the traditional context that we people tend to they tend to demonize everything and make it into magic, when maybe it's not magic. Maybe these are just extra senses that we have tuned. As if you walk into a room, you can tell if it's hot. You're not magical in any way because you know the room is hot. Your senses detect that. So I think that there is something to be said for that. The other thing I wanted, the other side of the coin, and it's something you addressed in your book, and actually you could help us all here, and myself included. The thing we addressed in the movie is if the Anunnaki had some sort of extrasensory visionary power of sorts, and you addressed in your books how when these creatures came here and began interbreeding with the half-breeded hominids that were here,
mm-hmm.
that eventually this would degrade their whatever trait they had, whatever genetic trait they had, because the beings that were here didn't have it. Eventually, interbreeding would do things like degrade their life expectancy, degrade if they had some sort of telepathic or sensory ability. It would be conscionable that that would be degraded over periods of interbreedings with non, let's call them all Anunnaki, just for ease of discussion.
Right.
My question is to you. We brought up the topic, which was another fascinating one in my explorations too, of the giants that were described in the Bible, the giant offspring of the gods who came and, you know, in Genesis took the wives of men. What size? Well, let me first state a statement, then a question. It's conscionable at people of those times, if these Anunnaki lived for thousands of years, 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 years, whatever it may be, to mortals at that time, that is as good as eternal lifespans, really. Even
sure.
To us, that would be pretty much considered
immortal,
living eternally for an uneducated person with our type of lifespan. My question is, how large to create giants would the original Anunnaki have been?
Well, that's a really good question. We do know that their DNA was unique in that, you know, on this planet, one species cannot breed with another species and produce offspring. With the rare exception of, say, horses and donkeys, you can get a mule, but mules that are sterile. The result, at least from archaeological evidence that we've been able to exhume, or evidences from drawings or carvings, is they range from about 9 feet, and there have even been 36-foot examples recorded. But now, keep in mind, the gravity on this planet is very hard on large organs and large, tall people on this world. So if you're 18 or 20 feet tall, and you're used to a 1,600-year lifespan, you're not going to live that long on this planet. The gravity is going to wear you out in a hurry. And we know from Old Testament writings that these giants were used to dominating normal humans, which in those days probably were somewhere between 4.5 and 5.5 feet tall. And they might have weighed between 110 and 175 pounds. We're talking a being with immense intelligence that can run 40 miles an hour, weighs between 300 and 600 pounds, and can really cleave a man in two with a single blow of a sword. So for all intents and purposes, they're gods.
Right.
The giants did not like to live a life of invalidism. So as they became paralyzed or less capable of that domination, they just simply committed suicide. They would drown themselves in the sea, or they would eat poison, but they would just kill themselves rather than live that way. And there were certain tribes that refused to breed with them and had to leave. They had to go to the wilderness to keep their genetic lines pure. And over the generations, of course, their genes were washed down through probabilities of subsequent generations. And some of those traits became recessive, which means it took two or more with that recessive gene coming together before that characteristic would show up again. Otherwise, it would just be recessive and never show up in a human again.
Right.
And it didn't take very many generations for that to happen. But that's in a nutshell, the genetics of it.
That's very interesting. And we actually address more of that in the next movie, which is the original story of the Anunnaki as the Sumerians told it. But what's also interesting is when you look at the flood story, which is addressed in this movie that we're in post on now, the big issue, or one of the big issues, that comes across as very vague and a little disconcerting is the issue of the biblical version talking about God's dissatisfaction and the corruption of man. And from both the biblical story and the Sumerian story, this coincides. This does jive for different reasons, but it does coincide. The thing that's drastically different is in the biblical version, God actually causes the flood. The Sumerian version doesn't really allude to the gods causing the flood at all. The Sumerian version basically states that the gods knew about the flood and just decided not to fill man in on it.
Right.
And again, not taking this from a scientific standpoint, just taking this from a average common day Joe rationalization standpoint, it's easier to swallow that.
Well,
then
you can make,
a being
you can
creating
make one,
a giant
one
flood.
Tiny jump, one tiny jump from that, and that is that maybe Noah and his family were shown a way to survive the flood and were told, you're only to save the righteous. So even in that description, they knew the flood was a prediction. They knew it was coming as a cosmic
cataclysmic. Oh, yeah, absolutely, and you're right on target with that. In fact, we'll take that a step further. In the original Zeasudra epic, which precedes even the Atrahasis epic by 1,000 years or so, the Zeasudra epic talks about Zeasudra was part divine. Zeasudra was a king of Shiparak He was a king in that area, and was the way it seemed to me, and this is my own interpretation based on what I've written, it seemed that he was part demigod related to Enki, the god who in the original Zeusudra and Sumerian stories fills in the prototype Noah that the flood's coming. So mm-hmm. it then gives you also, in addition to a little more to work with, it gives you more of an MO why this god would now go the extra mile to help this king survive the flood, because he was part offspring. He was related to him.
Uh-huh.
So that's all of these little things just make you sit and think and say, wow, you know what? Kind of makes more sense that one of the gods would go out of their way to help this one person survive and his offspring if they were related. And it also sort of gives you a little more rationale to understand why he may betray the rest of the gods' trust in not filling in mankind, because, again, it was one of his offspring.
In any case, there's enough there to fuel a fantastic movie.
The story is just so interesting, and I would love to be able to say that I could take credit for it. I can say that I could take credit for packaging it into a form that people can visually see, but the thing that's truly incredible to me is that this story has just been literally lying in ruins for thousands of years, and the majority of people, at least in our end of the world, don't know anything about it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, listen, last hour I did say that the second and third hour we would open up the phone lines.
Absolutely.
We will take phone calls. We don't want to just talk on the phone all night, because we have a lot of information to go through. But if you have a question for John Gress, our phone number, east of the Rockies, west of the Rockies, anywhere in North America, is 877-876-5227. And we'll take phone calls and your questions about the upcoming movie. And, of course, any suggestions that you have or topics that you want to talk about, but we'll try to stay on topic. I had a question. Do you think the Anunnaki came here to Earth equipped and intent upon performing genetic engineering on this planet?
Well, that's a good question. I think that according to the stories that I've had exposure to, they didn't come with the intent, at least at first, on doing that. It seemed to me that the stories of factions of the Anunnaki who were also here and became disgruntled about, as you had stated earlier, working conditions, perhaps their bodies unsuitable, if gravity is harder on them on this planet. The bottom line is the all of the ancient stories, some in way, shape, or form, express that the toil was too great for them, and the gods, the Anunnaki, the Igigi, started complaining to the great gods Enlil and Enki that the toil was too great.
Maybe the humanoids that were here were really not trainable, couldn't follow directions.
I don't even think they were in the picture at that point. Because, again, the span of years, and again, as you so eloquently state in your book, we tend to think very narrowly in terms of time because of our small space in this universe. But the time length, it could be one of their trips of many hundreds of thousands of years. Who knows? But the bottom line is, after a while, they became disgruntled with the working conditions and said, hey, you know what, we're not doing this anymore.
Yeah,
and
this would
pacify
be a lot easier
them.
If we had a slave race to employ to do this. I think we have a caller on the line. Can you give us your first name and where you're calling from?
Hello?
Hello.
Yes, my name's Gene. How are you, Mr. Agnew?
And you're calling from where?
I'm calling from Tennessee.
All right.
Now, I have a question for the person you're interviewing, and two questions, really. One's about software, and the other one's about the devil and his angels. First question would be, sir, do you use light waves in order to make your movies?
I'm sorry, say again?
Do you use a program called Lightwave to do your modeling and make your movies?
Yes, actually, we are primarily a lightwave house.
Okay. I have that program myself, and I'm
playing
with it. We're big
lightwave users.
That's cool.
And my other question was, does the devil and his angels come into play on any of this movie of yours?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear him.
Does the devil and the angels that fell with him come into play on this movie of yours at all?
Well, not per se, because, and I'll tell you why, and whether they do or they don't is not really the topic. What they were labeled, and again, this sort of gets into my whole position on not making my own speculations on things and just presenting the story the way the ancient Sumerians wrote them. If the ancient Sumerians, you got to remember that the biblical versions of the story, of all the stories that you read that were based on Sumerian stories, were written thousands of years later and in different languages. So if they called them something else, if they called one an angel, if they called another a devil, it's sort of irrelevant because the names change over periods of time with the stories, and the stories get modified too. The original Sumerian stories do talk of the Anunnaki. They do talk of different segments of the Anunnaki called different things, and a lot of which could be speculated have a lot to do with the angels who fell. There are stories of when the Anunnaki first came to Earth, how a segment of them were stationed here on Earth, a segment of them might have been stationed in orbit around Earth, some of them might have been stationed on the Moon, some of them might have been stationed on Mars, and how some of them in other stationed in other places, similar to here on Earth, when you send a provision of military out into the boonies somewhere, you know, you send 200 men to an isolated island and leave them there for a couple hundred years, they're going to get lonely after a while and say, hey, you know what, we're sitting here doing nothing or doing very little, and how long can we take this? And in some of the Sumerian stories, it does talk about some of those outposted Anunnaki rebelling and coming down to Earth and stealing women, which would, number one, coincide with the biblical accounts of the sons of God taking the daughters of man for whoever they want, and God was very unhappy with that, which also coincides with the Sumerian story of the great gods being really not happy about the situation of these other gods disobeying orders, coming down and stealing Earthlings.
Kind of like the barbarians, right? Pillage and plunder, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, and that, now can that be translated to the modern stories of the fallen angels? And actually, the eloquent section in Brooks' book about the fallen angels and the whole story that starts developing around great deceptions and the pivotal against good and evil, you can easily see where some of these things can tie in and support one another.
Oh, okay. And one more question, and then I'll hang up and listen.
Sure.
The ships that you designed,
mm-hmm.
are they not from the pictographs or hieroglyphics that I've seen in Egyptian temples?
The picture of the winged disc,
yes,
is a very popular, and this is actually very interesting. For those of you listeners who are who've been looking and seeing, you know, you go to stores where they have a picture of an Egyptian temple or Egyptian designed art, or we have a movie theater near here that the whole place is designed in an Egyptian motif, and walking in the front door they have this giant winged disc over the front door. If you go to our website, which it's on,
I have been there.
The X2 site, and you look at the ships we designed, we didn't really design them. We reverse engineered them to the drawings that were initially drawn in ancient Sumeria and in Egypt. Those are the wing disc design represented, supposedly, people who believe in interpretations, the sun god Ra. We sort of think that maybe these weren't such an interpretation, but a literal drawing of what they were seeing.
Right.
Well, if that's the case.
It's funny, when you look at those pictures, a lot of people seeing these ships is going to say, hey, I know that. I've seen that before. They're going to be very familiar with it. It's a very popular design.
Well, if that be the case, that's where the drawing came from for your ships, wouldn't that mean that the planet's not actually as old as thought through evolutionist theory and all this?
Wait, I couldn't hear the last part of what he said.
He was saying, that doesn't that mean that the Earth is not as old as the evolutionists say it is?
Well, but again, that's an interesting question. And one of the interesting questions that I'll sort of pose back is in dealing, and Brooks, again, you've discussed this in your books, there's definitively some sort of gigantic cataclysm that happened here on Earth, whether it happened once or twice or multiple times, or whether it happens once every few billion years or million years, it's definitively happened here. We have a large gaping hole in the side of our planet. We don't know. A lot of the Sumerian stories depict themselves that the stories came from earlier times. And when they talk about earlier times, they talk about pre-diluvial or even pre-Earth history times. So, you know, you've heard about the stories of Atlantis, the stories of, there's all these stories of civilizations that once existed. There's really no way of knowing. You may be completely accurate. The Earth in its current form may be less or more old than we believe it to be, but there might have been multiple civilizations that have been here through the millennia that we know nothing about. We may not be the first to inhabit this planet.
Yeah, they may have been wiped out in those cataclysms.
Thank you all very much for your time there.
Thank you.
I'll let you get some more callers in there.
Thanks,
you know,
Gene.
A great image from another movie was in...
see you later,
Eric. I forgot the name of the movie, but
Gene.
Mission to Mars, where they show an alien version of a meteor hitting what used to be a civilization on Mars.
Yeah, I saw that, the sort of movie that they portrayed for them as they came in, like a historical record.
I can't help but thinking that the writers and creators of that movie were giving a gentle nudge to us and saying, hey, that could have been us.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, I mean, the Anunnaki influenced the early civilizations in their writing and in their architecture and social structures. You're gonna develop this in your film, I know, but we know that they interacted with the Sumerians. This is the first record that we have of the Anunnaki and their origin and their activities here. And I guess, you know, many historians or anthropologists want to believe that the Sumerians sort of developed this on their own.
Right.
Do you think that the Anunnaki interacted with the Sumerians and that they actually shared some of their technology with them, and the result is what we have as a record from the Sumerians?
Well, again, I'm enjoying your book, if you couldn't tell. But again, I'll sort of point back to it, because you've arrived at a lot of the similar things that I have arrived at. I think it's pretty undeniable that when you travel all ends of the Earth, you find some commonalities that are just too conspicuous to overlook. You look at the design and the layout of step pyramids in every corner of the world.
Sure.
It's hard to imagine that all of these people arrived at exactly the same thing and created these things, the same design, the same alignment, by complete coincidence. So it would seem to me that that not only did the Anunnaki come to the region, which was Sumeria, but that they really were everywhere. I mean, they may not have been in such full force in other areas, or their stories and legacy may not have survived the millennia in other areas, but I would venture to say that they were probably everywhere. I mean, the Mayan ruins and the Mayan archaeology, I think, is and it's interesting, too, on a timeline, according to some researchers, the way events that were depicted in the Sumerian stories line up, the banishment of Marduk from Sumeria to the seas, over the seas, very much seems to coincide with the arrival of Quetzalcoatl in the South Americas.
Mm-hmm.
The leaving of Quetzalcoatl with the vow to return one day coincides with Marduk's reinstatement back in, he was, when in the time when Quetzalcoatl seemed to be in the South Americas, Marduk in Egypt was known as Amun-Ra, the unseen, because he was never around.
Hmm.
So it, a lot of these seem to, on a timeline, work out very well to show that some of the stories help support stories that are on the other end of the planet. So I would tend to think that they were in more places than just Sumeria.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Now, are you're going to develop or at least mention the interaction of this technology with the Mayans or the Toltecs?
In the next movie, we will. In this movie, we're basically kind of focusing on Sumeria only because it's so little known. I think a lot more people are familiar with things that people have seen, and maybe because we're in the Americas and have such a big influence from the Americas, that people are used to seeing Mayan art, Mayan, you know a little bit about Mayan, they know about at least about them. Sumerians, people seem to know almost nothing about aside from the name, and we've taken a special care in this movie to show a few things that people may have never seen before and try to get them as correct as we can archaeologically. For instance, we've done a recreation of a step pyramid and the outskirts of a Sumerian village.
I was going to ask you about that. You know, you could do so many things in the digital world.
Right.
You saw in Gladiator how they sort of finished the Colosseum, and it looks so real.
Exactly.
You know, how are you going to bring to life the backdrops of these ancient civilizations in your films?
Well, again, I have to give a lot of thanks to the original writers of the Sumerian story themselves, because they did a great job at telling the story so visually and dramatically. It's very easy to put yourself into that position. Now, it does take a lot of digging through archaeological information to try to get the information as correct as we can make it. And for instance, we had to build in the outskirts of the ancient Sumerian city small reed huts, because in the prototypical Noah's Ark epic, which is the Ziusudra epic, it talks about the Anunnaki Enki coming to Ziusudra, and who was the Noah of the time, and the way he starts out the conversation, because he's made a pact not to inform mankind of the oncoming flood, he says to him, he walks up to the edge of his reed hut and says, basically, reed wall, hear what I say, and to which Ziusudra said, hey, who is that? And Enki said, I can't talk to you. I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to the wall. Do you understand? You get it? And he said, Oh, yeah, I get it. What's up? So we know that there were reed huts in that time, and from what we've found through our research, they didn't differ that much from reed huts that are still used in the area even today. So we had to do a lot of research back into the early part of the 19th and 20th centuries, when people were from this country were allowed to do some archaeological research, and we found some early photos that were taken of the reed huts at that time. And we basically had to reconstruct from what we know now and then compare them against original, you know, 6,000-7,000-year-old Sumerian engravings, and it's very interesting to see that they're very similar. So we've taken a lot of care to try to do the best we can do at giving the viewer a new and realistic view of some of the pieces of ancient Sumerian history that have probably never been seen before. We have one scene in a scribal hut where scribes were taught how to be scribes, and it's, I don't think I've ever seen it depicted how they used to actually engrave clay tablets with a reed. I don't ever think I've ever seen that depicted in a movie before, so it's really just very visually entrancing to watch this going on.
Well, it's probably not unlike teaching children. They usually start at age 8 or 9 to write in kanji.
Right.
That is a very artistic written language, and it's symbolic, and the order of strokes has to be so precise, and they take great care in not allowing individual handwriting to influence the message. It has to be just so, and so even Japanese Americans that are in this country, their children go to Japanese school on Saturday,
right?
And they learn to write in kanji, so that if they ever have to travel back home, they can still read and write. Now, the scope of this idea, however, with all those backdrops and digitizing, it doesn't stop with pyramids and temples and huts. It extends to entire planets.
Right.
Are you going to tell the planetary scale of this story as well?
Well, in the next movie, we come at it from this movie. We explore it, and we will show a small. This movie gives you a taste of everything, because there's so much to see that it would be overwhelming to the senses. People just wouldn't pick up on a huge amount of that without being slightly familiar with what they're looking at, and to try to do exposition on all of it and inform people, well, what you're seeing is this and what you're seeing is that, would take a 10-hour movie. So we figured that to show everybody the key components of the Sumerian story, the key ideas, the stories, the characters that are a part, and to cleverly interweave the actual Sumerian stories with our modern-day science fiction so that they're getting both at the same time. Actually,
outstanding.
Sort of gives you an idea. Like, for instance, what we just were talking about with the Sumerian scribal school hut. What you're saying about the Japanese kanji writing system is exactly correct. However, a person listening to that would say that doesn't sound like it's going to be very exciting to watch. Add to that the factor, though, that in the ancient Sumerian version, they had a giant guy with a big stick whacking you on the head if you didn't do what you were supposed to do. Now you add a little tension into the scene, and it kind of gives you an idea where things can get a little more exciting than just watching somebody learn to write.
Well, you know, in some of the ancient Akkadian seals, we see these giants seated down. They have a crown on or a helmet of some kind, and they're teaching people about the stars, about the planets, about solar systems. Unfortunately, or at least fortunately for us, they're teaching them about 10 and 11 planet solar systems.
Right.
We only have 9 planets, but these seals go back 5,000 years. And
some of the seals show the planets. One of the key things, whether people dispute there's one seal in particular that I know you're probably aware of, where it shows a planet in pretty much proportional size. To me, even more interesting than that is that they show all of the planets surrounding a sun, which, as we all know, until very recently in our history, people believed we were the center of the solar system.
Well, I think that was rewritten by the Middle Ages,
very
where
true.
The religious government sort of confiscated all written or engineered documents and said, no, all this is heresy.
Right.
The Earth is the center of the universe.
Right.
Well, there were two leaders that you mentioned earlier, Enki and Enlil. And I'm not real familiar with it, just a little bit we mentioned in our book. These two leaders apparently trained and empowered their own mortal forces.
Right.
Who warred against each other from the days of Moses, well, down to these times.
Right.
So how important is this millennial war in your films?
Very. It's actually, part of that is actually central to the plot of the movie. And basically it extends even further than just these two characters. If you look at the ancient Greek mythology, that gives you a pretty good idea. People tend to think of, in terms of biblical events, as a very sterile environment. They think of a celestial being who is in a very puristic white environment with nothing going on and has only pure motives. And if you look at it from that, it's very sterile. When you look at the Greek mythology view of it, where you've got gods who are backstabbing each other and betraying each other and lying and cheating and stealing and undermining each other, that goes a lot more towards what the original Sumerian versions of the Anunnaki story are. So you have to understand that, number one, it was not uncommon, as it wasn't in biblical times, for intermarriages of between brothers and sisters and stepfathers. And in fact, it was even there were rules of inheritance and blood based on how pure your royal blood was, based on if you were married to your stepsister as opposed to, you know, it gets pretty crazy. But Enlil and Enki, the two main gods, were only two of the sons of the great god An, or Anu. And they had stepbrothers and they had cousins, and when they came to Earth, they had rules of inheritance based on whether you could be firstborn, but born to a concubine instead of to another god, and that would make your rank less than, say, if you were the product of a coupling of two gods.
Sure.
So there became all of these jealousies internally, whether you could be firstborn, who you would think would be the inheritor of the throne, but if you were born to a concubine and not to another royal, now you take second step to your younger brother, who is maybe, you know, born much later, but born with more royal blood. So this royal blood trail goes through history into our time of people being born to kings, and becomes the central pivotal factor of a lot of these wars, where a lot of the Anunnaki felt jealous and undermined that, hey, they came here, they did all the hard work, they trained mankind, they created, Enki in particular, created mankind, established all the colonies on the planet, and then his brother comes down and gets put in charge as king. So now immediately you have this rivalry going on, and then their siblings now get into the act, and you've got this all-out fiasco going on. It's actually like a giant soap opera.
So there is espionage and intrigue and plenty of action in your story as well.
Yes.
Ah.
And basically, you know, I don't know if I ever even arrived at this. When we first started in the first hour, we were talking about where this story is in the scheme of the stories. We basically took this and said, well, as our knowledge of what happened to the Anunnaki sort of dovetailed off after biblical times, basically, where are they now, and what would they be doing if they were still here? Where would they be? Obviously, I don't think it would be wise, if they were still here, for them to say, hey, I'm an Anunnaki and I live, you know, 10,000 years. I think that they would be the subject of a new anatomical study. That were probably the case, as we've heard in, you know, UFO related things. So they would probably do more, I think, to blend in with the populace and take on higher positions and try to fit in more than anything. So our story basically takes where are they now, and what rivalries are still going on, and what, without giving away too much of the story, let's just say that some of the rivalries that happened at the time of the flood, where Enki deceives the other Anunnaki and allows mankind to survive, there's some Anunnaki that are still bitter about that.
Well, I think I understand your passion for this idea, and that there's so much to learn. And of course, it's so different than the history that we have been fed by our teachers and our professors over the last, 10 centuries. I believe that film is the world's most powerful media for telling a story and changing the way we view things. Do you ever have the thought that you were prepared and meant to tell this story?
That I was what, I'm sorry?
Prepared and meant to tell this story?
You know, that's an interesting question. I I can say that I've been asked the question all the time, do you believe this? Do you believe the story you're telling? Do you believe this to be true or that to be true? And I have to say that, to me, it's never been about my personal believing or not believing in it. I actually, to be honest, don't really know if I believe or don't believe. I can say with definity that I believe that the story that we're arriving at makes a lot more sense to me than some of the other versions of the story that I've been told, but I can't say that all the pieces are there yet and that I can't get one piece that will completely overturn the whole thing again.
Yeah. I know in one of our earlier conversations, I described the determination.
Hey, Dr. Agnew, this is Dean from Tennessee. I'd just like to know if is there any evidences of the continued, you know, aggressions of these Anunnaki present times.
I'm sorry. I know we have a caller, but could you give me your first name and where you're calling from?
This is Dean from Morristown. I just want to know if there's any evidence of the battles with the Anunnaki going on now that he could cite.
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I kind of feel the way John does, that you know, maybe they wouldn't come out in open battle, but they might stay behind the scenes manipulating things with their great experience and maybe even sharing technology to make that happen.
You know, that's actually a very interesting point, and we've had many people on our news group who've come out and said that they believe things going on in the world geopolitical arena are a direct consequence of, and I mean, they attribute it to Illuminati, they attribute, which was really interesting is how many things I'm called. I've read in some news group, and I'm actually very vocal, and one of the reasons I wanted to do this as a completely independent production as opposed to trying to get financing and being involved in a quorum type of situation, I wanted to be able to present the story how I felt it should be presented, which is as unbiased as I can, the way it was written. And I've gotten emails, or I've seen websites where they say that I'm with the devil-worshipping sect, and this is the Hollywood's way of passing the message on. And I got onto their website immediately and said, well, I appreciate that you think I'm part of Hollywood, I think. but we're about as far from Hollywood as you get and still be in the States, and again, not part of any agenda. On another site, they had talked about this as a way of the Illuminati trying to mind control and set in motion a big propaganda thing. I could say that I didn't even know what the Illuminati was until I got that email, and I said, hey, that's an interesting thing to look up and see if that ties in. Devil worshiping, you know, fundamental religion, they all have a predisposition to think that there's some sort of push going on by everything that happens. Whether I'm destined to write this, I've met with a very good friend who's a very spiritual guy who says that I was.
Well,
and sometimes I wish I would believe that. Maybe it would help give me even more motivation than I already have.
Well, I'm not too worried about you worse than the devil or anything like that.
I'm
just curious, have you had any evidences that you've seen or heard of, or has anyone alluded to, of the battles going on now?
No. No. I have a lot of people from our news group who have say they have firsthand experience, firsthand witnesses. We have one person who gives us accounts all the time of mind control things that are going on, and we have another person who believes that they are have some sort of channeling ability and they get firsthand knowledge from Enki himself. I can't say that I have myself in any way, shape, or form. I think of myself more in the terms of a researcher who is trying to dig up as much information and present it in as even-keeled, original format as I can and make it visually exciting. I'm a storyteller. I mean, that's my love and my passion is in telling a great story, whether it's to this day I'll be reading a story to my kids and I'll say, you know what, this is a great story. This should be on film. My passion is in telling a great story and letting other people get enjoyment out of that.
You know,
it sounds like a great story. When's the movie coming out?
The movie should be out by the end of the year. We're still in post-production, and again, you know, over the years we've had, past year and a half, we've had a few setbacks, and people have said, wow, it's taken a long time. But by way of perspective, even a small Hollywood picture will have a few hundred artists working on it for a couple of years in post-production. We have literally a number of artists you can count on both your hands, and we've been in post-production for about a year to a year and a half. So we're actually doing fairly well.
Well, good. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dean. You know, kind of in support of Dean's suspicions, I kind of have those feelings, too, and a lot of people that write me or come on this program have the same ideas, that when you look at the evening news and you see the Syrians and the Iranians and the Palestinians and the Hezbollah and all, and they seem to be working together, they're coordinated, they're communicating. We can't figure out how they anticipate our moves or how they gain access to such high technology. But it seems as though generally, even when it comes to terrorism, there's a fairly good balance of power, a good balance of, not a good, but a bad balance of power, in the sense that it seems like they're much more organized than criminals ought to be.
Right. Well, you know, if you look at things from a biblical and ancient history or ancient mythology standpoint, and if these are the same, if the Anunnaki are still around and they're the same people who the Greeks base their Greek mythology on, and they have the same flaws and jealousies and choreography going on now that they did then, I sure hope not.
Yeah, me too. I don't want to see the scope of battles that we've read about in the days of Alexander the Great.
Right.
You know,
we've actually had one researcher who's been an advisor on the movie, who was in the Sinai, and he had actually collected while he was there a rock that appeared to be in this area of that all the rock is black and it appears scorched, and he's a very big Anunnaki enthusiast and researcher, and
mm-hmm.
he brought it back, and he does chemical analysis and that kind of thing, and he had it chemically and radiologically analyzed, only to find out, which confirmed his suspicions, that according to the Anunnaki story, and it's not worded this way of nuclear, the word nuclear doesn't appear, but by all descriptive accounts, and even the way it's described in Revelations, the wars and the big explosions, the big fires that were going on, were nuclear-based. And when he did this research, he confirmed his suspicion that the rock had higher levels of radiation than anything else in the area, which would confirm to him some of the researchers' feelings that the wars described between the Anunnaki, the wars, and we do address this a little bit, the incident at Sodom and Gomorrah, did involve some sort of radioactive weapon.
Well, you just look at Harappa. You know, it's was excavated, and it's a 25,000-year-old community, and lying in the streets of Harappa are skeletons of families holding hands, appearing to be running away from some kind of event, literally struck dead in the middle of the street, mid-step.
Right.
And their bones, after 25,000 years, are still more radioactive than those that were exhumed at Nagasaki.
Yeah, it's amazing to think that the Sumerian stories of the Anunnaki who came here to Earth talk about horrible weapons that they brought with them.
Well, I hope that we're not sharing those kinds of weapons with every power on the Earth.
I agree with you.
That would be alarming to everyone. The last few minutes of this hour, in one of our earlier conversations, I described the determination that great men feel when they continue working on their dream long after the money runs low or people say they should give up. Do you think you're driven in this way to finish this project?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's been a in the course of my career, I've done a lot of projects that look good and that were safer. But in the back of my head, I've always kind of been a risk taker when it comes to projects that I believe in. And this is a story that I've always believed I couldn't see how a story that the biblical stories, which are so amazing and extraordinary unto themselves, but based on these other stories that are thousands of years earlier and have so much additional detail to provide, how these couldn't be great stories that people need to see. I would have to agree with you. It's been a very motivating and driving force, especially seeing how excited people get. My actors on the movie, by the time we were finished with the first week of filming, they were all just, they would corner me and just start asking me questions.
Now, that was my next question, actually. What about your actors? What about the casting team? I mean, are they as excited as you are about this project?
I would have to say as much. And I would, interestingly, most of the actors, almost all of the actors had heard previous to being cast in the movie nothing about the Anunnaki.
Wow. So as they started, you know, reading the script or getting, you know, involved in the story, did they ever look up and say, is this really true?
You know what? All the time. And what's interesting is that because some of these characters are playing Anunnaki, they would ask me questions, well, why is he like this? Why did he say this? Why is he pitted against this guy? And why is this? Because they want to know the backstory. And then that, of course, opens up to more conversations, and their eyes just get real wide, and they say, is this right? Is this, was this real? Is this the way it was written? I said, yeah, as much as you want to ask, I'll be happy to tell you.
I wish you could see the goosebumps on my arms. So with the commitment of an entire team, much of the world is about to hear the greatest story ever told in the media of film, and we can hardly wait. In the past 2 hours, we have talked about history and cosmology and anthropology, and in the next hour, we want to address the questions about the destiny of the Earth and the race that currently lives upon it. X Squared Radio is a three-hour program, so if your local affiliate is not playing all 3 hours, you may want to give us their call letters, and we'll take care of the rest. In the meantime, we will take a quick 5-minute break for these messages, and we will be right back with more of X Squared Radio and our great guest, John Gress. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. Did you know that 11 of the 12 sets of footprints on the moon were made by Eagle Scouts? It's true. Soon, men and women will be doing the real moonwalk. But just so we don't forget, the first footprint on the moon has been replicated in a limited edition plaque that would make the perfect gift for a court of honor. Maybe you need something special for your office or your library at home. This high-quality plaque can add that something special that lets people know how excited you are. We are returning to the moon. Visit Countdown Creations at X Squared Radio today and order your limited edition First Step on the Moon plaque. Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean, a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They've come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, You will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. You know, thus is the place where the past meets the future. If you have done your genealogy and found that you have roots in the Irish or Scottish clans, then don't you think it would be a great idea to have a replica of your family crest? You can get a coat of arms, a ring, or even a family pardon that may help you or your grandchildren remember your ancestors. This is the time when the hearts of the children are turned to the hearts of the fathers. We only carry the best. So if you're ready to experience the glory of your past, you're ready to visit Scottish Heirlooms at X Squared Radio. People are always looking for something inexpensive and unique. Give people they love. Well, now there is a way to give a gift that not only says how long you will love them, but it also allows you to help keep the planet green and growing. Tree Givers at X Squared Radio is the company that will plant a tree on public land somewhere in the 50 states and provide your special person with a beautiful certificate of that place. This has become one of the most popular gift sites in the world. And because of their love for the earth, they are changing the world. So visit Tree Givers at X Squared Radio and see if you can find a gift for your special person. The space shuttle fleet is very soon going to be retired. No other spacecraft in history has advanced the world more than this fleet. I wanted a way to keep that memory alive in my home, so I went to the space store and ordered a 25-inch model of the Space Orbiter. People who have seen it always comment on the incredible attention to detail in this model. If you know someone who loves the space program and you want to get them a gift that they will never forget, you should visit the Space Store at X Squared Radio. Brooks Agnew here with X Squared Radio. If you like wildlife art and would love to add some of the most beautiful replicas to your home or office, you should visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio. They have everything from pandas to fish to eagles to horses in all sizes and price ranges. No matter what animal you love, they have the art for you. So visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio for that special someone today. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Our excellent guest tonight is John Gress, the writer and director of the new movie coming out called One Anunnaki. And I guess the second one is going to be called Two and Three and so forth, right?
Yeah, probably Anunnaki Two will be the second.
All right. Well, I know you're going to tell a magnificent story of history. And, of course, you're going to change everything we were taught about early civilizations. But there's a lingering question. If the Anunnaki came here, say, 430,000 years ago and mined minerals for centuries and were involved in genetic engineering. Do you think there is a possibility that they will return?
That's a great question, and one that I think is on the minds of anybody who's has any kind of interest in the Anunnaki. They wonder, number one, where are they, which was a big catalyst for spurring this movie. Where are they now, so to speak? And if they're still here, if they're not still here, where are they and are they returning? According to some researchers that we've been talking with over the past few years, the planet is on its return course, and although our lifespans aren't long enough, we won't get to see it, but it will be coming back, and apparently, according to them, the space travel is sort of the key question here, and it's one that's, of course, I was just listening to your commercial about the space shuttle, of key concern and of key interest to all of these topics is really the point of how do you get from point A to point B and be alive to tell about it, be survive long enough. Obviously, if they had longer lifespans, that would help attribute to their survivability in traveling great distances. That would solve one of the issues that we as humanoids have, is if it takes you 10 light years to get to X planet and your destination is, you know, 5,000 light years away, you're obviously not going to make it there unless you have some sort of other way around it.
One of the reasons that we launch so many missions to Mars right now is because of Mars's proximity orbit to orbit with Earth.
Exactly, and that is exactly what these people have calculated, is that the proximity to Earth is also a concern for the Anunnaki, and they believe that they can really, and one of the reasons that they believe that they set up Mars in ancient times as a way station is because on the return swing of their planet retrograde back through this, the gist of our neck of the woods, so to speak, Mars becomes a close jump for them to get to, and they have a window, like we have a window when we want to launch for someplace, they have a window of time that they can travel between the two planets and between Earth and there, and then whoever's still there when it gets past your critical window point, either you're on your way back or you're staying for a long time.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, now we are considering using the moon as sort of a way station, sort of a low-gravity launch point for Earth vehicles to go into deep space.
Right. And again, though, you still sort of have that barrier of time versus lifespan, which you said a key word right before the break, which was that we will talk about destiny. And
right.
Destiny is a very interesting word because the whole trilogy is basically based around the idea of destiny and the idea of some other parameters that you address also in your book, which is, and again, we've tried to base a lot of what we do not on just gobbledygook and hearsay. We've tried to base a lot of what we do. This is science fiction in the true sense of the word, where we've tried to base our movies on science, on real science that we know today.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the key factors that works in on the third movie is the idea of how do you get from point A to point B? And it's long been speculated, and you talk about it a lot in the book, on both it kind of revolves around some sort of grand unified theory of gravity and multidimensional ways of getting from point B to from point A to point B without going linearly through time. There's long been speculated some means of getting from point A to point B, sort of cutting through the fabric of time, so to speak, to the other end directly. And that plays a factor in the next movie, along with the idea that there may even be more to it than that. There may be some sort of predestined path that no matter which way you go, you're going in that path to begin with.
Well, it's sort of like large gravitational bodies put in motion in space to to say that it's predestined to go somewhere or it's aimed to go somewhere are two different things completely.
Right.
And long before, you know, physicists started addressing the question of wormholes and time travel and warping space-time, you know, science fiction played with it for a long, long time, until the indomitable Kip Thorne wrote a paper, an actual physics paper, on time warps and black holes, and later popularized it in his book, Black Holes and Time Warps, which was a national bestseller. Now, modern physicists are really seriously addressing this. In fact, they have built a series of observatories called LIGO, or the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatories, and true to Dr. Thorne's dream, they tied them together so that they could tell the difference between a truck driving by in Louisiana and a real gravitational wave. And they're looking. Now, so far they haven't detected a black hole directly, but we've been successful in detecting neutron stars and coalescing neutron stars, so we know that gravitational waves exist. And if they exist, then that means that space-time is actually being warped by these gravitational bodies. Well, someone with a lifespan of 5,000 years or 10,000 years and a civilization that's, say, a couple of million years more advanced than ours, might be able to negotiate one of those critters and be able to travel across vast distances of space as easy as we travel to the moon, which is no small feat in itself, but it's enough that it can be done. It's not saying that everybody could do it. So do you think at least, you know, some of the UFOs we hear about today might be either Anunnaki returning or continuing with their experiments, or do you think some of them never left?
That's another fantastic question, and another one we address in the book. What winds up happening over time is that the topic starts getting so muddied that you don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg. Now,
right.
We know that many triangular-shaped UFOs that have been sighted in our recent history have later been attributed to stealth aircraft that was later released as military experiments. Was that the chicken or the egg? Was the stealth aircraft modeled over some previously found extraterrestrial technology, or was that the actual extraterrestrial technology that people just thought was extraterrestrial and was actually ours? The UFO thing is very interesting, though. And again, I'll go back to when we first started reverse engineering the designs on the engravings and drawings that we saw. When you pulled in those wings, they very much look like your stereotypical UFO. We addressed and approached the same question to that we did with what would an Anunnaki do if he were here today. Well, if you had these ships, and obviously they came in some sort of number, because according to the Sumerian stories, they were here in the hundreds, if not thousands. What would you do with them? Where would you put them? They would actually be somewhat conspicuous, because they have to be quite large in size, at least not an easy-to-hide piece of machinery, I would think. And it's interesting that nobody's physically been able to find one. So we sort of backwards, while we were backtracking this, we stumbled upon another area of paranormal that suddenly clicked together and made some sort of strange kind of sense. The phenomena of crop circles came up.
Uh-huh.
And it was interesting how crop circles have been around for an enormous amount of time. And they originally started off very simply and have grown over the years to become incredibly complex in geometric formations and whatnot. But what interested me the most about it was when I was comparing the idea of where would you hide a UFO if you were still here and you had one. You could pull the wings in, so that would help you hide it a little. But really there's not too many places you could hide it. You could either hide it in a cave, underground, underwater. Aside from that, it's going to be found in this day and age in technology. But like you said, if you plan on using it at some point, you'd have to maintain it. You'd have to start it up every once in a while like the family car. You can't just leave it in the garage. It won't work. So what interested me is that the research that had been done on crop circles found very similar types of traits, which were the circular, the way that the reeds were pulled down in a circular vortex kind of a pattern. It had certain, sometimes they have electromagnetic properties to them and whatnot. But the thing that interested me is based on other stories that you refer to in your books about ancient Indian aircraft that they speak of, it would seem to me that they're all based on some sort of circular vortex type of motion or engine. And if you had one of these crafts that you were hiding underground and you started the thing up for its monthly or bi-decade tune-up, it might do something to whatever was above it. So that was kind of one idea that started popping around in our heads. But then one of the crew came up with the idea, well, what about all these really complex ones that are coming up? And one of my other artists said, red herring. If you were trying to hide the fact that every once in a while you had to tune up one of these things and start it up, if you had all these really intricately patterned design ones all over the place, where are the photographers going to go? Are they going to go to the boring round one, or are they going to go to the ones that are, you know, really cool geometric shapes? And it presented, again, along the lines of the same kind of idea of you get into these webs of intrigue that a lot of it's just red herrings thrown in there to throw you off the trail.
Well, that is that's fascinating. I know some of the crop circles are 300 and 400 feet in diameter, so if there are crafts underneath there, and they could be, you know, 50 feet or 500 feet buried under there, they'd have to be pretty large. But
right.
I find that fascinating, and what's interesting is that most of the crafts will be found in Wiltshire, England, which would be pretty amazing. But crop circles and even snow and sand circles have been found all over the world.
Just as a side note, we actually, to do a scene where, in the beginning of this movie, where people around the world, we didn't actually get to develop the whole theme as much as we would have liked to, but we actually had a crew shoot in on a farm in Scotland for the scene of the crop circle scene, and we have some people in Scotland who have actually had some dealings with these kind of things in their area, actually working on that scene with us. So it's very interesting. There's so many intriguing facets to the whole. It's very hard to tie it all together because, and again, like you said, with when you're dealing about where would they be now, what would you do with these things? If where there's proof of what is, there would also have to be some sort of misleading proof to keep people off the trail of what's really there.
I would think so. You wouldn't want the average trophy hunter digging up one of these things.
Exactly. So it would then become a the Da Vinci Code movie that came out was very interesting from the standpoint that it very much related to this whole web of deception that has to be created around the object just to keep people from finding it.
Well, I have a little bit of family history that goes back to there. Stranraer, Scotland is where the Agnews were established in Scotland, and not far from there is Roslyn Chapel, which also was under the purview of the hereditary sheriffs of Galloway, which were my ancestors. So we were all tied into that Freemasonry stuff, and if there's a place in Scotland I have to show you before you shoot the next movie.
That sounds great.
So if the Anunnaki are still here, say they left their mechanics behind to go from craft to craft to keep them tuned up, what do you think they are trying to accomplish now?
Well, you know what, interestingly enough, and going back to that word you left us with at the end of the last hour, destiny, there are chapters or words in the ancient Sumerian stories of the Anunnaki, which talk about them talking to each other about their thoughts and feelings on what their place was. In the very beginning, the main god Enlil and Enki, their first dispute was over, or their, it probably wasn't their first dispute, but it was their first main dispute that we know about, was Enki saying that the being you're looking for to do the work for us exists, and all we have to do is put our mark on that being, on the seed of that being, I believe it actually says, to get an intelligible worker, basically, and the really strong response was, and if I can paraphrase, by Enlil was saying, you can't do that, you're playing God. Which brings apart another interesting sidebar, is that it seems that they sort of believed in some sort of grand creator too. So even the belief in the Anunnaki doesn't rule out a grand creator type of belief. In fact, it almost supports that the grand creator created them too.
So that kind of goes back to Gene's question about angels being cast out and maybe they came here.
Exactly. We get to that whole area we don't really know, and we all we can do is speculate, but there's so much there to sort of support that these are where these stories could be based upon, that I think, at least for our purposes, there's so many similarities between the stories of the Anunnaki being coming down and taking people, the daughters of man, to parallel the angels coming down and taking the daughters of man. There's so many parallels there. I think it's you could draw that conclusion pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
But again, back to the topic of destiny, the discussions go to that first argument where Enlil basically is telling his brother Enki, who winds up creating man, that he's playing God, and he doesn't like that idea. He doesn't like the idea of diluting their genetic makeup with these other Anunnaki now taking Earthling daughters to be their wives. We see along in the story there's a pattern, and the pattern is that one part of the Anunnaki sect doesn't like the whole idea of Earthlings to begin with. They think that's toying with nature and that shouldn't be done. So there's this destiny tie-in. Are we doing something that's not right? Are we doing something that's morally incorrect and wrong? And
It sounds a lot like the argument that we're having in the press right now over stem cells.
Absolutely. It's identical in terms of playing God, and do we... you can take that across the board to creating new breeds of animals for work, to new breeds of vegetables to eat, you know. But what's interesting is in the end stories, this theme of destiny runs its course. And after the flood, and Enlil is the one who basically issues the command not to tell mankind about it, and Enki deceives him, telling the Isudra how to survive the flood. In the end, all the Anunnaki see what a horrible thing has been done by wiping off the majority of man that was created, and they come to a truce between them, which is reflected in the biblical version where God makes his pact with Noah. But the interesting thing in the Sumerian Anunnaki version is the discussion of them seems to turn to the fact that the issue we brought up before about them staying on this planet too long, and by now man will outnumber them, and it seems that the subject turns to, will we now as lords of mankind become the servants of them? We might be stuck here, and will we become their servants? It goes to the whole Oriental belief in cyclical natures, and so it's actually very interesting that the idea that they had an idea of destiny, and by them coming to this planet and creating mankind to serve them, would they in turn, would the destiny be that they ultimately become mankind's servants? And we play that into the third movie.
Wow, that's interesting. And even if there were some that were left behind, as if they weren't already outnumbered, now they surely are. And if they want to continue their purpose and keep pushing destiny in the direction that they want to, then they're going to have to get involved somehow with Earth people, with mankind. And they can't just do it by standing up in front of armies and saying, you will obey me.
Exactly. And you know, the thing that I think is a very important point, which gets very overlooked in most of the discussions of gods versus Anunnaki versus some sort of extraterrestrial being, is the supposition that the Anunnaki are immortal and not prone to any type of harm, I think is part of the thing that is a threat to people who don't want to take on the possibility that this thing, that they may actually have existed. When in fact, the stories of the Anunnaki show that they do kill each other. There are many stories of Anunnaki killing each other, and that by all respects, aside from them maybe being larger in size and, you know, vitality than humans, they were prone to being killed. So they were not immortal from the, they maybe have been immortal from the age perspective, but in this day and age with armor-piercing weaponry, I really have very serious doubts that they would want to speak up and try, like you said, to stand in front of an army and say, you will obey me. They're as susceptible to injury and mortality as we are.
Yeah, well, look at Cain and Abel. I mean, they were destined to live, you know, 800 or 900 years along with their father Adam and their mother Eve, and yet, you know, Cain slew Abel.
Right.
So Abel's dead. He's immortal in the sense that all of his organs will function and his skin won't grow old and wrinkly and his eyesight won't fail, but he can still be dismembered.
Right, and you know what, it's interesting because that's another story that we don't address in this one, but another one of those, like you had said in the first hour, of what sparked me and my interest, one of those discontinuities of biblical stories that caught my attention very early on, and the Cain and Abel story was one. Everyone that's familiar with those stories is familiar with that part of the story. There's one line in that story that kind of caught my attention, and that's the line in the story where God is addressing Cain and says, you're banished for killing your brother. And Cain replies, but you can't do this to me, and I'm going to paraphrase, you can't do this to me, whoever finds me will kill me. Well, if there's only Cain and Abel, who else is there to kill him?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's one of those little inconsistencies in the biblical version of the story that, again, people who are fundamentally religious-based might think, oh, that's an attack on our belief. But it's really not. It's actually in support of the original story that story was taken from, because that all ties in with the Noah's Ark and the Zeasudra epic, where the survivors then go, in the Noah's Ark epic, everyone's wiped off the planet again. But later in the biblical version of the story, the daughters of and sons of
Noah
go to find the descendants of Cain.
That's right. And
there's a complete discontinuity there that everybody was wiped off the face of the planet.
And when they arrive, the people ask, you know, where did you come from? You know,
right.
Who are you? And they say, well, we sailed across the cosmic sea.
Right.
And here were these beings, Noah and his entourage, that could live, you know, 750 years, and they were blending with or taking to them to spouse people that only lived 50 to 100 years.
Right, exactly. And that is just, I mean, putting aside the belief structure that anybody might have, whether you believe in creation or you believe in evolution, from my position, it's a fantastic story. I mean, it
sure
is just, it's unimaginably exciting to hear this kind of a story with all this new information that people don't haven't ever heard.
Well, we have to come to the realization, even if you only read the Bible and no other works on the earth, we are not alone in the universe.
Right.
Before you get out of the book of Genesis, you meet five different races. There aren't just humans.
Right.
There's Nephilim, there's God, or the gods that were in the Garden of Eden, there's Adam and Eve, and then there's a whole other group of humans that were created in the seven-day period before Adam got here.
Right. You know what? And that's very interesting, too, because as you touched on in your book as well, the original Sumerian stories, to me, helped me to put the whole story as best I can see it into perspective, because they don't necessarily counteract the biblical version. All they do is explain all the details that don't seem to go along with each other. They fill in a lot of the gaps where you're set. Where, as you said right now, the beings that were created, it explains the Greek mythology stories of half human, half horse, beast, and that coincides with the Sumerian stories of Enki's attempt to create man. They failed on the first umpteen times of the experiment. It tells of how of the first version the organs didn't work right, and the second one the eyes were blind, and on the third. So it wasn't magical in the original writings. It was actually very pragmatic and scientific the way they described what they were either told or saw, in that there were many failures in the creation of man.
You know, 10 years ago, these stories of genetic engineering were only science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Now, however, I watched some of the debate as President Bush was vetoing the legislation. He said a very interesting line that surprisingly has not been repeated in the press. In the live version, he said, as he was looking down at toddlers who were once frozen embryos, he said, "These children are not spare parts." I just thought that was so profound, and then here, you know, we are making great strides in genetic engineering, and it's not inconceivable that not 100 years, maybe 10 years from now, we will be able to do remarkable things with at least tuning out deformities in the human design, like, say, diabetes or heart disease or a Parkinson's disease, or even be able to repair nerves or even cure our first virus, for heaven's sake.
Right.
We still,
and you know,
can't do that.
It's very interesting when you compare that against the Sumerian tales of the creation of man. In the Anunnaki's trials and tribulations in trying to perfect this creature and get out the bugs, so to speak, to make a creature that's healthy and workable.
That being said, do you think we, as ostensibly descendants of Adam, this traveler race that came here, do you think we have a deeper connection to the ultimate creator god that perhaps intimidates the Anunnaki?
Well, you know, I'm sort of biased that is most definitely a possibility. I'm kind of biased, though, just pragmatically, towards the concept that the reason that some of the gods didn't like the idea of the Earthlings was not because we had a closer affinity to a perfect being, but more that they felt that it was their genetics being tampered with, and that they were basically diluting their line, and they didn't like the... I mean, and I know this is a very far-out and maybe objectionable way of looking at it, but if humans now decided to start intermarrying with other primates, I think that would raise a really big controversy and stink in this world of ours, and I think that if those now start interbreeding and creating this other species of half-human, half-hominid, half-primate, I think that there'd be a lot of people who would object to that, not want to see these half hybrid, you know, human primates walking around, and now if they began to be overpopulated and outpopulating the humans that exist, I think there'd be a huge problem. And I think that that's, if you look at it from that context, and that's the context that you would have to put yourself in the position of as the Anunnaki who came here, it makes perfect sense.
Oh, I can see that from the
context. Yeah, it makes perfect sense why they didn't like the idea of humans.
Sure. Sure, from the point of view of the Anunnaki, I can see that that point of view exactly.
And that, again, supports the biblical version where God in Sodom and Gomorrah is wanting to wipe mankind off the face of the earth for this behavior, because it would be akin to that same sort of parallel. It's a race that was created improperly for them, and now it's setting a bad, in quotations, moral example for their race.
Right.
You could sort of see from that perspective where that could make logical sense, if not, you know, historical sense.
Well, let's just talk about the making of the film just a little bit.
Sure.
What about your actors? How did you choose the cast that you have, and you know, how are they developing as characters?
I'll tell you, you know, that's a very interesting question, because at the time, and again, we're now, from the time we cast the movie to film the movie to our post-production, we're looking at a good 3 years. At the time when I cast the movie, we've actually, with the website and with the knowledge of the movie, we've had a lot more input from the world community as to their ideas and whatnot about the Anunnaki. At the time, we had a little less information than we had now,
mm-hmm.
and one of the key components that was unsolved to me was the factor of how do we get the diverse looks of humans today, and we couldn't really, it was one of those blanks that I chose to leave blank, because you've got people who say that the original Anunnaki were along the lines of what Noah or Moses or Noah was when he was born. You have the, you know, white skin and light hair and light eyes. You get that. But then you have this diverse range of people here. So were there different groups of Anunnaki with different genetic characteristics? Some people sort of lean towards the fact that there were whole other alien races that they were sharing the planet. There's all kinds of really crazy ideas. So what I did in casting was I said, you know what, this is an open hole. I'm going to cast this with no predisposition towards any physical appearance on the part of the Anunnaki. Whoever comes out with the presence that I like and who has the presence to deliver the story mm-hmm. in its best form, regardless of their race, their creed, their anything, we'll get the part, and we really try to choose everybody based on the way they played the part, the way they adapted to each.
I think that tone means we have a caller on the line. Caller,
okay.
Can you give us your first name and where you're calling from?
Anne from Michigan.
Oh, okay.
Hi, Anne.
Good evening.
What's your question?
I was wondering, I've been listening fascinated because you're talking to a true believer here. Have
Great.
You ever heard of a book called The Only Planet of Choice?
No, I haven't.
I haven't either. Who writes it?
Pardon me?
Who writes the book?
Well, it's actually a compilation by a few people. The main authors are a woman by the name of Phyllis V. Schlemmer. Also another woman by the name of Mary Bennett. I guess she's the editor, and there's several others. And by the way, you can find this on Amazon. I actually found it in a used bookstore. And
A World of Choice?
Pardon me?
A World of Choice.
No. The Only Planet of Choice.
Oh, I gotcha.
And then : Essential Briefings from Deep Space. Now, this book is like no other. And it's very credible, and it follows, I would say, probably about 98% of everything both of you gentlemen have been discussing.
Wow.
With an extremely extensive index of references, footnotes, and it cites some of the people you mentioned, like Sitchin. It's very compelling. I'll put it to you that way. Now, just something for you both to check out. I think that it would corroborate much of what you're talking about. I will tell you.
When was it published?
I knew you were going to ask me that here. In fact, I just pulled it up online here right now.
I am a writer. I have to know these things.
Pardon me?
I'm a writer. I have to know these things.
Yeah. I believe, strangely enough, I can't see it right here, but I believe I'm going by memory, and it's a book that you've got to read probably at least 20 times here to really absorb it all.
Most of them are.
Yeah.
It's pretty heavy. But I believe it was actually, before I answer the question, let me just tell you in a quick but roundabout way.
Sure.
This was actually channeled information. And I believe Phyllis Schlemmer was the medium. And it was a group of interesting people who were allowed to be present, including a gentleman by the name of Gene Roddenberry.
Wow.
Who you might have heard
of.
That
name.
Now, going back to your question about when it was published here, I believe, because this was actually taken from notes. It was all documented over a series of meetings which went on for years and years, I believe, beginning in the 70s. And,
wow, sounds fascinating.
And it, I believe it was actually printed, I'm going to say, late 80s, early 90s. I could be off by a little bit. But I'm telling you, you absolutely must read this. It is, it'll just blow your mind. Now, the reason I mentioned this book, besides the fact that I know you want to know about this, I just to add to your conversation quickly here, just think of the best way to convey this here. It was suggested by the person who was, or the being, I should say, who was being channeled, and they call him Tom, who is from, I guess, a series. I believe there was like 12 levels and of kind of a order, if you will, in the universe. And it was suggested that not only did beings that one you referred to as the how do you pronounce that, the Anunnaki?
Anunnaki.
The Anunnaki. I'm not saying that properly, they corroborate that, but they also go on to suggest that there were many others.
Yeah, that's what we've kind of alluded to tonight, that the Anunnaki might not have been the only visitors to this place.
Well, I'll tell you what, it goes into great detail in this book.
You know, it's funny that you bring that up. The people that I had suggested in the first hour that we had talked to over the past few years by way of our news group, the people who were that got their or obtained their information in some sort of channeling method, almost, I would say the majority of them make the suggestion that there were many, many, many. I think they are the main believers in the multiple alien idea, that there were not only just one group, but there was
dozens,
more than one group, and they were warring factions, and I think that from there then stems some of those the topics that I had, Brooks, I had mentioned before about the giant conspiracies where one group supplants another and then demonizes them when they were the original creators of mankind, but now we are actually worshiping gods who is it gets very twisted and very confusing. Even, you know, imagine being a person in this day and age reading information that we've been subjected to our entire lives, only to find that perhaps the information was rewritten by somebody else, and the people we're thinking are the demons are actually the good guys who were thrown out. And
mm-hmm.
It gets very convoluted. And my first impression of it, when I first started started getting these type of information from the news group, my first impression was, yikes, this is so confusing and so contorted. How would you ever make heads or tails of it? And not that I dismissed it, because the piece of truth that ran through that wild conspiracy issue is that this is something that we've dealt with, again, throughout our history as well, about people coming in and rewriting. So, you know, how do we know which was the original story, and how do we know which was the original text? How do we know that we are believing in, you know, people soften over a period of time. And again, that's part of the story in this movie as well, is some of the gods who were the, let's call them the fire and brimstone type, have mellowed over the past few thousand years. You know, they're not kids anymore. they're living in a world of technology and not such a barbaric world anymore, where they have to live here with us a lot of times as well, although they have a different agenda. So,
well, this book, I don't mean to interrupt you there, but it references exactly that, and it goes on to explain how that history directly relates to the current geopolitical events going on now.
I think that's completely fascinating. I have a question for you, Anne.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that our planet Earth is in store?
You know, I can barely hear you.
Do you think our planet Earth is in store for something grand and perhaps terrible?
Well, yeah, I was going to say grand. I'm not sure if grand is the right word. Let's just say big.
Yeah, our planet is in store for something big.
Yeah, no doubt.
That is a good feeling to have. I hope you're waiting for the movie One Anunnaki to come out, and hopefully you'll see it, and we'll hear from you again.
Yeah. No, I've been really enjoying this discourse here, and by all means, please check it out on Amazon, this book. You need to read it, please.
I will do that.
Thank you for that.
Okay, and thank you so much. I'm enjoying
this. Thank you for the
call, Ann. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You know, it's interesting. I had actually, I can't place it off the top of my, I have a very huge library of pretty much anything I come into contact with that's related to at least the scientific issue of the archaeology behind the Sumerians, or, and again, everything from the original Oriental Institute in Chicago to, I have pretty much everything that I know has been printed, and I'm the first person, if I hear something like this, I'll be on Amazon tonight. I remember somewhere in my archives of my memory reading about somebody who did this same sort of channeling thing, and I can't say that I'm really a proponent of it. I'm open to it. I'm open to seeing what they have to say, but I thought it was fascinating how they talked about the whole writing of a book the same way, but they talked about the experience and the person who wrote the book had like a helper, and the helper was in the room, and the helper would from time to time write about the experience of this channeling experience, and would and at one point had actually come into contact themselves, and it was a both a fascinating and terrifying thought the way that they presented, because they were not as used to dealing with that as the other person, but again, it's something a little far-fetched for some people, maybe even me, but at the same time, I always try to keep an open mind and an open book, because, you know, I meant to bring this. When I was reading your book, one thing that I hope that you've read a long time ago, but popped into my mind when I read the first few chapters of your book was the book, I think it was written in the 1800s, called Flatland.
No, I don't think I've ever read it.
You need to find a copy of that book. It was written a very long time ago. An amazingly interesting book. It's a book called Flatland. It was written long before, I think, the serious discussion of multidimensional.
Who was the author?
You know, I'd have to find it, and unfortunately, I'm not near where that book is right now. But
okay.
I'll get that to you. And basically, the story is of a world of two-dimensional beings. They only have height and width, but no depth. And one day, a sphere passes through their world. And basically, what it illustrated was about maybe 5 to 10 years back was when I happened upon the book, because it was mentioned in a scientific article about what would a multidimensional object look like in our world. And,
right.
and they talked about the fact that we would never be able to really see a multidimensional object. All we would be able to do was see somewhat of a shadow of it. And the way they described it was, in if you were in flatland, all you could see is basically a line in front of you. And the line would either get bigger or smaller or fade off or get blurry as it faded off distance from you. But you, that's all you would ever be able to see. And if a
sounds
sphere,
like it sounds like the mathematician Riemann wrote that book.
It could have been.
It was very interesting
because when you picture a sphere passing through a two-dimensional plane, there would be nothing. There would be a small dot, then extending into a line, back to a dot, and then it would disappear. And that kind of is what all of this, trying to find out what the Anunnaki were and time travel, it's all very much like. It's, in a way, it's trying to make sense of these odd shadows.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. And interestingly enough, we take, you know, measurements all the time. We super collide particles together. We look for radio waves and light waves and all kinds of different radiations from our planet and also from space. And what we see are the effects of other dimensions on our dimension. We can't directly detect the other dimensions, but we can see their effects. And one of the things we very quickly realized is about somewhere between 94 and 96% of our universe is made up of something we can't see, which is
right.
dark matter and dark energy. It explains why the galaxies revolve the way they do and why stars are perturbed the way they are, but all we can see are those perturbations. We can't actually detect the energy, so that makes for fascinating physics. But I wanted to know what your plans are for introducing this film to the world.
Well, we've actually had numerous invitations already to appear at film festivals and such. Honestly, I'm trying to approach this very much from a both a film point of view, and in addition, because we are a completely independent production, I'm looking at this with an eye towards the next movie, which is enormous in scope.
Sure.
Could be, if the next movie was a Hollywood movie, it would be one of those most expensive movies of all time category. So I am looking at it as you know, strategically, from a strategic business sense, to build our audience base before we go out for a formal release with it, which is already, if you've seen our member map on our website, is already growing. We're in so many parts of the world. I get regular emails from everywhere, you know, when is the movie coming out, which is my goal is to be able to have enough of a fan base that we will be a success whether we release it ourselves or we go with another distribution company, so that we can roll right into making the next one, which will be, whereas this one's a gentle introduction, the next one will be the full story and will be a tidal wave.
Right, right. Well, I want to know what film festival you're going to debut at, whether it's Cannes or whether it's Sundance. And I'd very much like to be there when this happens.
We will definitely let you know.
Well, I really appreciate that. This has been absolutely fascinating, and I can't believe 3 hours has gone already.
I know, it's gone quickly.
I'm fascinated by it. I'm intrigued by it. I know our listeners are. We get a lot of calls. I've gotten emails from people. That's one of the reasons I contacted you. People were emailing me going, hey, have you heard anything about One Anunnaki? When is it coming out? You know,
right.
John, get a hold of it. So, and I'm excited about at least being able to supply, you know, some exposure. We don't have a huge audience, but with the BBS radio network and the changes that we're making, it looks as though we will have at least 10 to 15 million people before the end of this month who will hear this interview. And that will build your fan base as well. Is there a website or a news group that listeners can join to offer their support?
Absolutely. We have our website is just simply oneanunnaki.com. If you do a search on the internet, Google a search for Anunnaki, we're usually about the first thing that pops up, I think. You can go to that. That has up-to-date information on the movie. Our website has behind-the-scenes photography from the shooting of the movie, and it's a little out of date right now because we're such a small production team that when we move from web production back to the production of the movie, basically that leaves nobody left for web. We don't have an on-staff web people. It's all our own artists. So, but well,
we might be able to fix that for you too.
Yeah, we're doing a lot of updates to the website as we speak. We have a link back to your site on the site now, so that people can come listen to the archived version of this if they want to refer that on to other people. But oneanunnaki.com. We have a news group on Yahoo Groups. If they want to go to Yahoo Groups and do a search for One Anunnaki on there, we'll pop up on the group. And that's, again, we've had this discussion group for a number of years now, and some amazingly intelligent, articulate discussions. Every now and then we have some, you know, off-kilter, paranormal-type discussions, but you'd be surprised at the level of integrity and the level of intelligence in the community of the people on the website from around the world come in, and these are scientists who've been in their off hours looking at some of this stuff and saying, wow, this is really incredible. On our website, we also have, we just recently put up just information about the movie. We have an online chat on the news group, a Frapper map that where you can log on at the bottom of the One Anunnaki site, click on that, it'll take you to our map, and you can put yourself on our maps to show where you are, and that's helping us to do some marketing material so that we know where to make sure we have a fan base to open up the movie there.
All right.
We have marketing material, t-shirts, stuff that we have on sale, all kinds of stuff. Just check out the website.
Yep. Plenty of ways to get involved, and we want you to get involved and pay attention to One Anunnaki.
And Brooks, I'm like you. I answer all my own emails, so it may take me a while to get back to you, but if people want to email, I'm happy to reply.
Our pleasure to have you here. Sorry, just a moment. Technical difficulties. I do have to end right on time, so I do want to thank everyone for being with us, and I definitely want to thank John for being with us. John Gress, our guest, absolutely fascinating interview. I am overwhelmed that you were able to make it, and I appreciate your appearing.
Thank you, Brooks. It's been an absolute pleasure. I'd be happy to do it anytime.
All right. Thank you, John, and we'll be back in touch.
Thank you. Take care.
And we'll talk after the show.
Okay. Bye-bye.
It has been our pleasure to have you here this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we try to provide the best 3 hours of talk radio on Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours where you live, send the call letters of your local radio station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, who you are. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Be aware that every life is immensely valuable. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.